Hello, and welcome to the Above Average Irrelevance podcast. Today is Wednesday, March 9th. This is episode 5. I'm Matt Weaver, and I'm here with Scott Nelson. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning to you, sir.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing as well as I think I can be.
You know, often people say, can't complain. I never say that.
You
because I complain. I can always complain.
That's okay. It's yeah. So it's you know, we're here in Minnesota and it's astonishingly warm. I mean, it's been above 50 degrees for several days. Almost all of the snow is melted. We are in strange times, my friend. It is not common for it to be this warm this early. I saw a Lamborghini parked on the street yesterday because somebody decided, you know what I want to do? I want to take my Lambo out and sandblast the paint by driving on the roads that still have 4 inches of sand laying on them.
But it's 70 degrees out. So
but it's 70 degrees out, so screw it. That's how weird it is.
Yeah, it's, I mean... What, March 9th, maybe, you know, we could start getting this warm. But the crazy part is here 2-3 weeks ago when it was this warm, you know, in the middle of February. That I have never seen before.
I'm not going to complain because by February, middle of February, end of February, I'm done. I'm done with winter.
Yeah.
I'm done with the cold. Every time it snows and I have to go shovel the snow, I'm enraged at the futility of it all. So,
and
I'm happy.
In fact, we live in the middle of the country, so we're never going to be submerged underwater. You know, so why do we care, right?
Global warming, baby. Yeah. Okay, should we get down to business?
Yeah.
Let's talk about the zone.
Yes.
Your new diet.
Yes.
Tell me all about it.
So I started doing the zone. The name, the zone... The idea is you're trying to keep your body in the zone, which is like the premium or the prime metabolic state for high energy and for fat burning. So the idea behind it, like the main premise is balancing your macronutrients. So you start off by figuring your body's protein requirements based upon your lean body mass. Once you have that determined, then you eat equivalent carbohydrates, equivalent fat, to get like a 30-30-40 ratio.
Okay. 40%
carbs, 30% fat and protein.
Okay.
The idea is you want to have 3 primary meals and then 2 snacks interspersed. It's one of those where you never want to go more than like 5 hours without eating a zone compliant,
right,
you know, meal or snack. And that's the basics. So this is very different from what I was doing before because I was doing a paleo-style diet, very low carb, not counting calories really or measuring anything. You know, you just eat what you want as long as you stay in certain food groups.
Yep.
Whereas Zone is very structured as far as what you can eat and in what combinations you can eat it.
Do you like it? Do you like it better in your paleo diet?
I do think maybe I have a little more energy. I do feel pretty good on it, and I think that's the carbohydrates.
Fuel.
Yeah. This diet does still stress the quality of your carbohydrates. So the carb portion of it is very focused on like low glycemic index foods, trying to keep your blood sugar balanced.
So there's no Snicker bars for your carbohydrates.
No. Well... That is one positive of zone, right? I can eat anything I want as long as the macros balance out. Now, it excludes a lot of things because it's impossible for the macros to balance, right? Like when I'm eating pizza, pizza's impossible unless I wanted to have a slice of pizza plus a chicken breast, you know, because it's like all my carbs are going to be in one slice of pizza, but between the cheese and the meat, there's not enough protein.
Sure.
You know, so it kind of precludes eating very unbalanced foods. When we were at Chipotle, you could never have a Chipotle burrito because you could either have the tortilla or the rice or the beans. But if you eat all 3 of them, then I would have to eat, you know, 15 ounces of meat to counteract it.
Which is a lot.
Right. So when you're trying to maintain the macronutrient balance, it restricts what you're able to eat, which is a good thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, then you aren't eating very calorie dense, you know, highly concentrated type foods, which...
So the ratio provides a natural break on unhealthy eating.
So far it's going well. Trying to eat good carbs is kind of hard because, like, you know, I'm a big guy, so I eat, they use a block system, but it's really no different than like exchanges or points or whatever. Like X grams of protein equal a block, Y grams of carbs equal a block, you know?
Yep.
So I have a lot of lean body mass, so I eat 19 blocks. And so it ends up being a lot of food. Well, if I wanted to get all of my carbs for a given meal from broccoli, for instance, which is a preferred carbohydrate source.
Low glycemic index food,
I'd have to eat 5 cups of steamed broccoli. That's a lot of broccoli.
I mean, I like broccoli, but I don't like broccoli that much.
Right. So I've been trying to do the best I can with veggies and then supplementing with like some quinoa and fruit and things that are not necessarily things that are higher glycemic index wise. Sure. But I just can't eat 5 cups of vegetables with every meal.
Imagine how long that would take.
It's lots of chewing. I'm getting like a jaw workout. Yeah.
That's right. I have giant jaw muscles, right?
Yeah. So far though, it's going really well. You know, I've been doing it a little over a week now. The main reason I started doing this is I had kind of reached a plateau of weight loss doing paleo. For me, paleo is a great way of eating to maintain a given weight, but I get to a point where it's not good for weight loss because there are a lot of like meat and nuts and there's a lot of things that I tend to overeat and they're very high calorie
dense
foods.
Yeah.
Since I started doing this now, I've lost like a little over 4 pounds in the week. So I've jump started that weight loss again, I feel like.
That's awesome.
So we'll see how it goes. It's a lot of work because you have to construct these like, you know, compliant ratio meals. So I've been doing a lot of, you know, I came up with like a couple of things I like for breakfast, a couple of things I like for lunch, dinner, snacks, and then I'm just repeating the same foods.
Yeah. You spent a couple of days working out a diet for the month. Right?
Yes.
So, and is repeating the same foods going on? I mean, you're only a weekend, right? But it's not a big deal.
So far, it's not. I mean, I am I like just eating meat and vegetables.
So the unrelated to the diet, but I listened to the America's Test Kitchen podcast, and they talk about one of the ways to become a really great cook is to master a very small number of recipes. Like, really learn how to cook 2 or 3 recipes. And you do that by repeating them several times. It's not about once every 3 months pulling out the recipe and following the recipe and doing it. It's about making the same recipe repeatedly.
So you have expertise.
Until you have expertise in it and you can kind of do it without the recipe. And you know, you know, when there are subtle variations, you can accommodate them. So I have wondered, as you've started on this diet that is revolving around relatively few meals that you're cooking at home, just to simplify the process for you of knowing what is a compliant meal for you and the purchasing of food at the store, mm-hmm. I've wondered if you'll gain some sort of kitchen mastery from cooking the same meal, you know, several times a week for the next X number of weeks.
I think so. It's the interesting thing is I don't do a lot of cooking. Like the easiest way to create these balanced meals really is just eating whole foods. Mm-hmm. Like once you start mixing together a lot of ingredients,
But you're making like an egg bake or something for breakfast.
I am doing an egg bake for breakfast. Most other meals, it's just like a meat and a vegetable. So I'm learning, you know, I have a repeatable process for how I roast broccoli and how I cook chicken breasts and how I cook ground beef and that kind of thing. But then I'm just kind of putting together foods to make meals.
Yeah.
Not necessarily doing a lot of cooking. The egg bake went pretty well too. An interesting thing there is I eat a lot of eggs, and this diet does not like yolks, as certain diets do and certain diets don't. This one is anti-yolk. So like for my,
because of the cholesterol.
Yeah.
So the Zone has been around for a while, which means when it was originally written, the prevailing scientific consensus about eggs was likely different than it is now, right? Because eggs are one of those foods that they're good for you, bad for you, for you, good for you, bad for you.
With coffee and red wine.
Right. Has this diet been revised and updated as different scientific consensus around certain foods has changed over the years?
That's a good point. I should look into that. I mean, the book that I'm using as my starting point is probably 15 years old. So It is not necessarily updated. Well, I can't do just egg whites. I don't find that to be fulfilling. So I'll do like one egg and four egg whites because it's 2-to-1. Like an egg is a block of protein or two egg whites is a block of protein.
Right.
So if I want three proteins, I'll do one egg and four egg whites.
What do you do with the yolks?
I buy egg whites at Costco in a carton.
Oh, okay.
Because I can't waste them. I mean, that feels so wasteful, I think, to just like put the yolks down the drain. I could make homemade ice cream out of them.
Yeah.
And then I could have 2 tablespoons of it.
Yeah. You'd have to give it to your neighbor or something.
The fats are tough, especially coming from a diet where I was eating lots and lots of fat, mm-hmm. because a fat block is 1.5 grams of fat.
Which is nothing.
I get 19 blocks a day. So, yeah, so in a given meal where I get 5 blocks of fat, you know, it's less than 10 grams of fat.
Yeah, you can get that much fat by, like, looking at a pile of almonds, right?
Exactly. Like, a serving. Well, so macadamia nuts, a block of fat is one
one macadamia nut.
So if I wanted to get all my fat from macadamia nuts for a 5-block meal, I can have 5 nuts. So you kind of have to choose your fats wisely. I mean, I've been doing a lot of avocado. I've been doing some oils, like I like toasted sesame oil drizzled on like cabbage or, you know, something like that. But the fats are problematic.
Yeah. Walnuts. Well, it's a giant change from where you were.
Yeah. So I do like blueberries and Greek yogurt and walnuts as like a 2-block snack. But it's like, I don't know, 3 or 4 whole walnuts is it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. So far, so good. I'll keep you updated. Like, I plan on sticking with this for at least a month.
See how it goes.
And see how it goes.
So. All right. Well, that leads us into the next thing, right? You highlighted a couple of articles about what we eat and how that relates to cancer. There's a lot of kind of research going on here.
Yeah, several things came out this week. There was that article on NPR about starving cancer cells, essentially.
Right.
Using a ketogenic style diet, like not feeding. I mean, it was basically saying that cancer cells feed on glucose, so you deprive them glucose and they do not grow as rapidly.
Yeah, and so the thing I found was really interesting about it is, you know, as opposed to thinking of cancer as the, you know, the nucleus has a mutation, and so that mutation causes the uncontrolled cell replication, they're coming at it from the mitochondria are behaving badly, and they switch the energy process that they use from, now I'm going to forget the terms, but the process by which we use oxygen versus one that's more like fermentation. And then once they start behaving badly, that causes the mutation in the nucleus. And then we have uncontrolled cell division, AKA cancer. And so they are coming at it from a metabolic standpoint of how do we prevent the mitochondria from going sideways. And this is not a new idea, right? Like, it was a German guy, Warburg, in the 1920s that was working on this stuff, right? And then he actually won a Nobel Prize. I was looking him up in Wikipedia before this, but he was a Nobel Prize winner. And then he was Jewish, and then the Nazis, and he was somebody who was the Nazis were hypocritical about. So he was allowed to continue his research despite his religious heritage. So, because Hitler himself valued the cancer research and had a fear of cancer. So, but anyway, his idea was this metabolic sort of view of cancer. But then there was this other MIT article, right? Mm-hmm. So there was this NPR article about, you know, hey, maybe there's this ketogenic way we can control the metabolic process. And then this MIT article was talking about how the foods we eat have some relevance to how cancer grows. But they were coming at it from, glucose is a relatively small amount of what's going on in your cell, and the bulk of it, the bulk of the weight of new cells is coming from amino acids. So they didn't make as many, that article didn't make as many claims about the direct relationship between what you eat
yeah.
and what's going on in the cell. Mm-hmm. But they did say that, amino acids, aka proteins, seem to be the bulk of the molecules, right, of the weight of the cell. And I came away with the impression that they felt like that was the important part, mm-hmm. which is almost contradictory to the NPR article that says, you need a super low carb, ketogenic style diet, right?
So to try to starve it. And the MIT fat is the only safe nutrient, right? All fat, all the time, which is in direct contradiction of conventional wisdom regarding.
Yeah, but the this MIT article and the NPR article, at one level, they seem to contradict each other about the conclusions they're drawing, about what you should eat. But on the flip side of that coin, they're the same.
And they're basically saying what you eat or eating contributes to the growth of these cells in your body.
Right. And contributes to how likely you are to develop cancer or for cancers to grow rapidly in your body. Somebody is really trying to get you in your phone, right?
Okay, fine. I'll turn it off. It's because the vibrate is so loud. Have you ever noticed how violent the iPhone vibration is?
Sometimes it seems that way. Here the phone is sitting on a
hard surface, right? It's worse.
But I don't know. I don't know if there's some algorithm that your phone could determine how much it needs to vibrate based on its location. Like, sitting here, it's relatively quiet and it's a hard surface. It could vibrate less.
Yeah.
If it could somehow detect that that was the case. When it's in my pocket and I'm in the car and the music is banging and I'm going, 100 miles an hour down the interstate, it needs to be more vibrate-y because I don't hear it half the time. I don't feel it. I don't hear it.
It could do that, right? It could, it can listen for ambient noise.
The beauty of it is, now that we've spoken this has become prior art. Nobody can patent it.
Oh, sweet.
Sweet. So,
back to the subject at hand. My phone is turned off. So the only answer is to stop eating.
Well.
Period.
Maybe. I have read a book written by a guy named Campbell and his son, whose name is Campbell. It's called The China Study. Have you ever...
I've heard about it.
You heard of this book?
Because any discussion you read about paleo or anything you read about paleo, that
somebody
tends
brings
to be the
up,
counterpoint, right?
Right. Somebody brings up
that
the
Asian
China
people eat tons and tons of carbohydrates and, are very healthy and lean.
Right, because
Explain.
They eat almost no animal protein.
Right.
Right. At least that's the argument put forth in the China study. I don't feel compelled to debate the merits of it or not, but it's another piece of data in the what you eat matters a lot about your health.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I don't know if that's a contested opinion or view anymore, but certainly we seem to argue a lot about what to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And people who know that they should eat something different don't. I mean, I'm overweight. I need to lose some weight. And I know I need to eat better. And I do most of the time, but not all the times, right? Sometimes it's like, man, I'm having 3 beers and a candy bar. And I know that's wrong, but I'm going to do it.
Right.
And I don't know why that is. There's a weird psychology wrapped up in
pleasure food. Centers of the brain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
I don't know. You know.
What does that mean?
I read Hacker News a lot, and lots of health articles tend to come up on there because I feel like, you know, programmers, hackers, people who are intellectually curious want to hack their life too, and they want to find their prime.
The nerds want to figure out the
right. They want to figure stuff out. But then you start reading like comments on articles and stuff, and everyone has their crazy opinion and everyone has their advice. Well, I did this and lost 50 pounds and this is the ideal way and this is the ideal way. And then they want to fight about it and debate it. And,
wasn't there like there was that Super Size Me documentary where the guy went and ate a McDonald's for every meal and he gained a bunch of weight, and then some other crazy person said, "Yeah, well,
I eat Twinkies for every meal."
And didn't they also go to McDonald's for every meal and lose a bunch of weight? So
because they were strictly counting the calories and I think about this a lot. Like I have my opinions. I know what diets make me feel the best and support my athletic performance and weight loss goals and whatever, but I'm surprised that there isn't more definitive, that science has not come up with a definitive answer of the ideal human diet.
I think it's because we have the moral and ethics not to create truly definitive studies that operate on humans.
Yeah.
I mean, if you could lock humans up in a cage the way you do rats, you could probably figure it out.
You would have to essentially control someone's eating for their entire lifespan. But I don't know. Like, to me, that seems like a conceivable thing to do in, like, the modern scientific world, is to say, we're going to take these people. You would have to, I mean, have adults who are volunteering to do this.
Yeah, but then
and we're
going to
monitor their eating for 40 years, you know?
Well,
and their physical activity and their fitness, and
but they do that by asking you to remember what you ate. If you could like implant some sort of chip in the roof of my mouth and literally scan everything that came across my lips and went down into my gullet, then you could probably have truly accurate data.
Yeah. So then the other article I had put was on intermittent fasting.
Yeah.
That kind of came up again this week because it was in the New York Times. And that's something that, I don't know, I keep kind of seeing resurging. Lots of times people who are into paleo-style diet are also into this intermittent fasting concept.
Have you ever done it?
I do occasionally. Usually it's if I eat like a really huge dinner and I just feel disgusting and I wake up the next morning and I'm like, I need to just not eat anything until I get hungry again.
But that's basically missing a meal.
Usually when I do that, I won't eat until the evening meal the next day.
Oh, okay.
So, that's not quite the same, but I don't do a scheduled fasting. This was more, actual scheduled fasting. Like every other day I only eat one meal, or I consume all my calories between a narrow window, you know, in the late afternoon, evening kind of thing.
Yeah, there was that 5-2 fasting diet, which is five days of normal and then 2 days of like 500 calories a day or something.
So that concept is in direct conflict with how the zone works, or diets that say, you know, you should be eating small meals all the time, right, to keep your metabolic engine revving kind of thing. I kind of struggle with what's the better option there. Because it's direct contradiction to say you should be eating a little bit of food all the time, constant drip, you know, and you should allow your body to, you know, clear out all the energy and get hungry again. And I don't know.
Well, and, you know, the studies that show that fasting can improve your, you know, your markers for diseases and whatever else that, that demonstrate the health benefits. I mean, food is a chemical you put in your body. You could argue it could, you know, some of the foods, maybe many of the foods you eat are poisonous in some form. Oh. So by choosing not to eat or not eat very much for a couple of days, does your health improve just because you've ingested less poison?
I mean, yeah, I mean, it is just less eating. You know, a few years ago, I read a big article about fasting that the, like, contention was that essentially your digestive system is prepared to, you know, to process X number of cycles, you know, like billions of cycles or whatever, relating that to calories. So over the course of my life, my digestive system is prepared to digest a certain number of calories.
10 billion calories.
At which point it starts breaking down, right? There's a useful lifetime.
This is
in
the
your digestive system.
But your, like, your heart is going to beat however many times.
Right.
And then it's done.
Same concept. So if you want to eat 5,000 calories a day and then exercise, you know, to maintain your weight, you're working much harder on your digestive system than if you are fasting or, you know, eating low calorie and then just not overexerting energy such that you need more calories.
So if by this theory, then The Rock, you know, Dwayne Johnson, should be dead pretty soon, right? Because he
right.
eats like a bazillion calories
yeah.
and burns a bazillion calories to maintain his gigantic physique.
Right. So I don't believe that there's a fixed number of cycles that your digestive system can function. But there's something to be said for, you know, the more you eat, the more your body is working and the harder that is, right?
Like, yeah.
I don't know. That's kind of an interesting thought. Like you say, you know, fasting means ingesting less poison and it means digesting less food. I mean, less work for your kidneys and your liver. And
well,
I don't know.
Could be that part of the reason that fasting seems so weird is that here in America, going hungry is a very alien concept, right? I mean, the, you know, there's the, oh, what's the cartoon with the little kids? South Park. You know, there's the South Park where they have that exchange student from, I don't know, somewhere in Africa, and, you know, they take him to a buffet. And, you know, he's oogling at all of the food that's going to waste, and they're, you know, they're being very American about it. Nah, this is... I had 2 bites of this. I'm done with it now, right? Bring me something else, right? And so the idea that you would specifically choose not to eat runs very counter to our culture of plenty.
True.
Maybe the answer is they're all right in some way.
All things in moderation?
Yeah, something like that.
Hmm.
So...
Oh, we didn't solve it. We didn't come up with a perfect diet, did we?
There is. Yeah, there is.
Till next time, I guess.
There is no perfect diet, right? I don't know. If you could choose a perfect diet, it might be, you know, coffee, beer, and Twinkies or something like that, right? Like, if I could choose what would be the ideal diet. But I don't get to choose. All right, what else do you want to talk about? Should we talk about this new Microsoft stuff?
Sure.
So I had seen some headlines this week that Microsoft is going to allow SQL Server on Linux. It seems to be an acceptance that the whole world, you know, Windows is not going to gobble up the world. And if they want to increase the dominance of their tools out in the world, they have to accept that there are other legitimate platforms for them to run on, Linux being one of them.
Right.
So, I think it's great. I think it's it'll be fantastic for Microsoft and their customers to have another option. not tied to Windows. I think it's good that Microsoft is considering a post-Windows world. The idea that Microsoft has contemplated its future without Windows at the center of it is probably going to be what lets Microsoft do the next brilliant thing.
Yes.
And SQL it Server might be why on Linux.
They survive.
Yeah, know? SQL Server on Linux is not the next brilliant thing.
No.
But it demonstrates a certain advancement in their corporate thinking.
That's the thing that I find most interesting is it's kind of a paradigm shift. And, you know, I've read before that that's kind of because of the post-Ballmer era, essentially. Like, Ballmer was a very Microsoft all the way down kind of thing, right? Like, you're running on Windows, you're using SQL Server, you're developing in .NET, you're using Visual Studio. Like, we only play nicely in the Microsoft sandbox.
But Ballmer was Bill Gates' right-hand man, right?
Right.
So he grew up in this era.
Yeah.
That was the dominant thinking. So I don't know that I fault Ballmer for it, but it seems like the world has moved past that model, and which is why he owns a basketball team and not he isn't the CEO of Microsoft anymore. Right.
So it also posted in here Microsoft joining the Eclipse Foundation. You know, they've always been pretty anti-Eclipse because of the Visual Studio products that they are pushing. Well, then, you know, I think Azure kind of pushed some of that. Like, if they want people deploying in their cloud using non-Microsoft technologies, they had to support plugins into Eclipse to do that. And this is kind of one step farther, I think. It's not inconceivable to me that you'll be able to develop .NET applications in Eclipse with Microsoft's blessing. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's another result of this advancement in thinking that Microsoft is having. It makes me wonder, though. I always think of Eclipse as kind of an IBM-ish thing because it came from IBM a long time ago. But IBM is has support for running Swift apps in IBM's cloud solution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you could say the whole universe has lost its mind, right?
Yeah.
IBM is letting you run Apple, you know, derived code in their cloud, and Microsoft is letting you develop programs in IBM tools to run them on Linux.
And, you know, application-wise, now Outlook is one of the most popular email clients on iOS devices.
Yeah.
Like, Microsoft has made that big push into Office and Outlook on iOS, and it's very popular. It's supposedly very, you know, I've never used it.
Right.
It's supposed to be a good application. So
I have read that as well. That's a no-brainer, though. I mean, all of Microsoft's Outlook users were not using Windows Mobile. They were all using iOS and Android. So if you wanted to keep those seats, which I assume are a lucrative business for them, you know, I'm sure all of those CIOs were saying, well, I need a way to get, you know, my employees' email on their mobile device, and we're not buying Windows phones because they suck, right? We try giving them to employees and they just lose them or break them. So
coasters,
you know, I need to, they want iPhones and Android phones. And, what do you got for me? Right. Either make it work with Apple Mail or give me an application that works. So, I don't know that that's as indicative as other things in Microsoft's change in thinking, because that's you don't have to be a very smart guy.
Right. That's just a straight up business decision.
Yeah. That they have chosen to embrace it and make a brilliant app is fantastic. Good for them. Competition is great.
Yeah. I think this is exciting. I've never really been a Microsoft hater. I'm not a Microsoft lover, but I would love to see amazing new products come from Microsoft. So if this enables it.
Yes.
Great.
Not a $3,000 VR helmet.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see where that goes. I don't even want to talk about VR.
Me either. Some other day.
It seems like vaporware. I know that you can buy this stuff, right? But nobody on planet Earth is going to spend any kind of this kind of money for this sort of stupid stuff, right? Because it still comes down to, I got to wear a big thing on my face. Right. Nobody's going to do that.
We'll see.
Don't get me started.
No. Okay. You had a link in here about the ransomware on the Mac.
Oh, yeah, on Transmission.
We got to talk about one strictly Apple.
Yeah, did you...
Topic.
Did you read anything about this at all?
I read it, and I do use Transmission.
Did you have 2.90?
No, and I don't run it on a Mac. Okay. And I think... I feel like a few years ago I made a decision that I'm no longer doing anything involving BitTorrent on my machine, like my daily driver machine or on a computer. Well, it's on a computer, but like I have a Raspberry Pi.
Yep.
With Linux installed where I run my Transmission client and do my downloading and everything. Just, I mean, one of the reasons is just for safety because, you know, I don't trust a lot of stuff that's being downloaded in that ecosystem, right?
You mean there might be dishonest people on the internet?
Exactly. So I was particularly interested in it because I do run Transmission, but not on a Mac. So
what I did see an article yesterday where they released more information about how and what happened. And it appears that the binary that they produced and deployed on their website
and was signed
by them was replaced with a binary that was signed with a legitimate Apple developer ID, but a different one that somebody had basically stolen.
Okay.
And they broke into the server and replaced the binary with this extra one that has this ransomware embedded into it. It was unclear to me if, I don't know if Transmission produces an MD5 hash or a SHA hash of their download, if that was also updated on their website. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But the virus effectively was injected because the attackers broke the security on the server hosting the binary.
Right.
Which, to me anyway, is less worrying than some rogue developer injected code into their source tree and they built it unknowingly because they had no way to detect it. That still may all be true, but that's not the attack vector that was taken.
Yeah, I do agree that it's less worrying, but I think it's still worrying. I mean, this same thing happened a few months back with Linux Mint.
Yep.
A version of Linux, same thing. I am more and more reluctant to ever download and execute something from the internet because of stuff like this. Even, you know, a year ago when there was that big thing that came out about stuff on SourceForge, like,
yeah,
you know, well-respected software and products like FileZilla was the big one in that story. You download FileZilla from SourceForge, which was where the FileZilla projects told you to download it from. And it had some sort of, and that it was less malicious. It wasn't ransomware, but it was some sort of adware or toolbar or something, you know, yep, to make money. I feel like that's happening more and more and more to where I am reluctant to trust anything, you know, that's an open source product downloaded and executed from a website.
It made me wonder if there was an opportunity for someone here to improve this problem on the internet, right? If you're willing to trust a developer or a development community in the case of an open source project, for them to produce a binary, so if they produce a binary and they produce an SHA-1 hash, right, of whatever their binary is, oftentimes, you know, they display that on their website. So you can download it and MD5 some or whatever, the binary, and see if you get the same hash that they generated. And that's helpful to determine if you're getting you know, an error in your download. But if somebody breaks into your server and replaces the binary, they could update the HTML page
right.
with a different hash.
Right, unless the hash is coming from an independent source.
So it makes me wonder, could Apple or could AgileBits, the people who make 1Password, could they produce some sort of hash escrow service by which, you know, they issue, you know, a certificate to a developer. And so every time the developer produces a binary.
Right. At the point in time the binary is signed, a hash is transmitted back to Apple.
To a third party. It right. doesn't have to be Apple, but a third party. Right. and then when you download it, if then there was an app, you know, before you did anything with it that could take the hash and then go verify the hash with the independent third party mm-hmm. and determine if it was a match or not. Then if, even if people are breaking into
right.
download servers and you can't trust the hash that's
yeah.
given to you on the web page, there would be an opportunity for you to determine that the binary is not the same binary that was
right.
produced by the developers. It still doesn't mean that there can't be a rogue developer
no.
or a nation state that's going to do something bad, right?
But it kind of introduces like two-factor signing. I mean, a lot of this is supposed to be solved by the problem, you know, by the idea of having a signer certificate from Apple, mm-hmm. right? So is that how they, you know, I didn't read how Apple stopped this, but I read
they
headlines
revoked.
That said Apple stopped it. So did they revoke the certificate?
They revoked the certificate that had been used fraudulently for the affected binary because it was a legitimate certificate. So they revoked that and then they updated their gatekeeper software mm-hmm. to specifically look for this ransomware on the Macs, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, Apple has some things in place, but it was still dependent on a bunch of people being, you know, infected, basically, and
right.
until a human being noticed. It seems like what I'm advocating for is some way by which, you know, binary downloads could be verified before you unzipped it and installed it.
I think that makes a lot of sense.
Maybe one day it will be popular enough that the AgileBits crew will listen to it in this podcast, and they'll decide that that's a brilliant idea.
Do we get a patent on that, too?
I don't care. I just want it solved, right?
Yeah.
So many things that could be patented, I don't want the patent. I just want the solution.
Yeah, that's part of the reason why, not to go down a whole other rabbit hole, but I'm very disappointed with the direction that the App Store has taken, because I feel like it introduces a level of control, the Mac App Store control over things like this. And it's, I mean, you're never going to get the transmission client in the App Store.
No. Did you, on that topic, did you listen to the talk show with John Gruber when he was interviewing Eddie Q and Craig?
No, I kind of read like a summary of what was said.
Overall, I thought it was a very interesting discussion. The, you know, everybody has their pet question that they wanted Gruber to ask. Mine was the Mac App Store, right? There's been a lot of relatively high-profile developers walking away from the App Store, and there's a lot of commentary on the internet about its perceived problems. There's not a lot of commentary about the problems that the App Store solves, and this could potentially be one of those
yes.
things.
You would never get an update to an application signed by another certificate loaded into the App Store, you know?
You'd hope not. I don't know if you could, but you'd hope not, right?
Right.
Because well, I guess I don't know if there's a human review process for the Mac App Store the way there is for the iOS App Store. But the you would hope that that would be noticed and it wouldn't happen. But I guess as much as I don't want to live in a walled garden, a lot of times I actually want to live in a walled garden,
yeah.
right? Because I don't want to have to worry about, this sort of craziness, right?
Mm-hmm.
It would be nice if I had a better chance of detecting bad actors before something irrevocable happened. But, yeah. This is the world we live in.
Yep.
So, what else do you want to talk about?
I think that's all I had on my slate.
I have one thing.
Oh, yeah?
So, a good friend of mine was... I don't know if giving me a hard time is the right way, but he was giving me a hard time yesterday about, you know, you're spending all this time going to the gym, running on the treadmill, trying to be healthy. He's like, why don't you get a Fitbit or something to count your steps? And I'm like, well, I know the days I spend on the couch, you know, or sitting in a chair behind the computer all day, I'm lazy, and I know the days when I'm not. Why do I need a Fitbit for to tell me that? Like, I know that. And he's like, yeah, but do you really know that? I mean, you know that, but you don't know that. There's no objective number staring you in the face, right, saying, hey, fatso, those 2,500 steps yesterday ain't cutting it. So he made a strong case for something to measure your activity level at a gross level. He's like, it doesn't have to be some super fine-grained, you know, highly detailed study of every piece of your fitness, right? But something as simple as step count, whether it's accurate or not, as long as it can be related to tomorrow and yesterday, right? Can be a valuable tool for helping you determine your level of sloth. That was his basic argument. And I'm still not sure that it's the right answer, but that's a powerful argument. Now, you are Mr. Activity Monitor.
You could have fireworks on your wrist, my friend, if you meet your step goal. That's what I got.
Is how valuable, I mean, I know that you are using a heart monitor during a workout and you're trying to maintain, you know, your heart rate and certain things. So you've taken a very technical approach to some of your workouts, which is fine. Mm-hmm. But in the broad scale of measuring your activity overall, how valuable do you find a gross step count number every day?
It matters.
Yeah.
I will frequently, if I'm close to meeting my goal at 9:30 at night, I will go for, you know, a mile walk in the evening outside just to get over the count. Yesterday, my gym is about a mile and a half from my house. I walked to and from the gym to pad my step count because I had time. I don't think I would have done that unless I was, you know, consciously or subconsciously thinking I got a number on my wrist that I'm trying to hit.
Okay. So you,
when I was walking to the grocery store a couple days ago, I had gotten a cup of coffee and I noticed if I hold the coffee in the hand that I'm wearing the wrist, it's not counting as many steps. So I must shift the coffee to the other hand. So my arm is swinging and I get credit for my steps. I pay attention to it. I really do.
And it helps you.
So I think so. I mean, I think if you're under the belief that any movement is better than no movement, then gets me moving. This watch does do this thing where if I sit still for more than like the Apple Watch does, if you sit still for more than I don't know what it is. I think it's about 60 minutes.
Yeah.
It says move, you know? So a couple of weeks ago I was helping at the community theater here building set. And so I was like staying in a localized place, like screwing in a bunch of 2x4s and stuff, like working really hard. And I was just like dripping sweat, you know, and I've been working out, doing all this work, but I wasn't like, I wasn't moving, walking, right? And so my watch kept saying, move, move. And I was like, so it is kind of dumb in that regard, right? It can't gauge relative exertion, you know? It just wants you to, it wants motion.
Yeah.
It wants mileage. That's not totally fair. But all in all, yeah, I think it does. But I mean, you already have this with your iPhone, right? If you have your iPhone on your person all the time, which you mostly do, counting your steps.
Well, I mostly do, but I don't when I'm on the treadmill.
Okay.
Right, a significant number of steps I get almost every day is on the treadmill. Hmm. Where the phone is sitting on the pedestal running the podcast app, right, with my Bluetooth headphones in. It has no idea what
you got to put it in your pocket. Or on your armband or your fanny pack, right?
You don't even want
to. I have specifically said, right, I refuse to have my phone on my person.
So stop.
When I'm exercising.
Stop telling me what you know to be crazy, right? An iPhone 6 Plus, right? The Plus phones are not workout phones. Maybe if I was Andre the Giant.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Giant. Then the phone wouldn't matter. But
the other thing is, you know, it's a small barrier, but it's enough of a barrier that you have to go in and look at it on the phone. It's not just there. This is in front of my face. You know, every time I look at the time, it goes back to your thing about a dashboard. If you had a dashboard on the wall that was showing you your step count, maybe a Fitbit does that, you know, assuming you're glancing at it.
Well, I'm not, I wouldn't get a watch because I think almost all of those fitness watches are not great.
Even the little belt clip things have a display, you know, that you see the number.
So I did look yesterday. Fitbit has something called the Fitbit Zip, which is their cheapest one. It doesn't do stairs. It just does steps, basically. It's $50.
So the next step up, the one, that's the one that I had for quite a while. And it does...
It does steps. Steps, stairs, and...
And it does sleep, right? If you don't care about that, then I guess that's fine. But
the sleep would be interesting, but it goes beyond my tolerance for BS, right? To have to wear some giant thing on my arm with the thing shoved. No, that'd cramp my style too much. So no way, not doing that.
Since I got this watch, you know, I never really did the sleep stuff with my Fitbit One. I've never really done it with the phone. Yep. Since I got this watch, I do leave it on 24/7. And that's something that's kind of gotten used to. If you're not used to sleeping with a watch on, and I mean, this is a full blown watch. It's not just like a little wristband or something, you know, it's kind of weird.
Your Garmin Vivio Tech 4793.
But I do. I think the sleep stuff's interesting. I don't know.
What does the sleep stuff tell you?
Really just tells you, I mean, it's tracking the number of hours, which I just am kind of interested in.
What has it told you? Have you made any changes resulting from that data?
I do try to go to bed earlier, usually unsuccessfully. I mean, there's a little bit of visibility to, hey, I only got, you know, 6 hours of sleep for 3 nights in a row. I'd be better off if I got 7, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
All right. Well,
so are you going to do the Fitbit or are you going to think about the Fitbit?
I want to go touch it. So I have now found a reason to walk into my local Best Buy.
The horror.
That store is such a disaster. But, so I will wander in there and look at it.
Okay.
For $50, maybe it's worth it to try it. I have issues with Fitbit's architectural decisions because it's not getting injected into HealthKit in the most efficient way possible.
And
which means that all of this data that's going to be generated is going to be siloed off into Nowheresville because...
I know. I hate that. You can never get it back. They have no API.
They do have an API.
Oh, do they now?
Yes. Mm. But it's off... It's going to be over there. And it's not over here with the rest of my stuff. So that kind of drives me a little crazy. And from a purely political standpoint, I wouldn't want to give them any money to support that decision that I disagree with. But at the end of the day, maybe my health is more important than my politics.
Principles?
Not principles, it's politics, right? Mm. I mean, that's, you know. I can get something out of it, maybe. And maybe for $50, it's worth trying it. So, we'll see. That could be the next great experiment. That's what I got.
That's all I got.
All right.
Let's call it.
Another successful podcast. Have a good day.
You too.